This is Scenic Roots, talking writing. Most histories of the US, as we all know from high school, tend to concentrate on whatever made the front pages of the newspaper in any given period. The lives of ordinary people are rarely recorded in history books. But one of the reasons a new collection from the Schomburg Center in New York is notable is because it does just that. Titled Unsung, like many other conventional histories, it collects essays and speeches addressing the plight of enslaved people in the US in the 19th century. But it also includes many first-person narratives from black people describing their lives both before and after the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863. The compilation, which focuses on the histories of black people as agents and architects of their own lives and ultimate liberation, was curated by our guest, Dr. Michelle Commander. Dr. Commander is the Associate Director and Curator for the Lapidus Center, where her research centers on transatlantic slavery in the 19th century. The Lapidus Center is part of the Schomburg Center in New York City, which houses over 11 million items, illuminating the richness of global black history, arts, and culture. In the course of her research, Dr. Commander has made a number of trips to West Africa. On one trip to Ghana in 2016, she took a taxi from the airport to the university. At one point, the driver of the cab pulled into a darkened parking lot and ordered her to sit up front beside him in the cab. Dr. Commander jumped out of the cab and ran down the road, with the cab driver chasing her. He caught up with her and was holding her pinned against a wall when several young men on the other side of the road, seeing what was happening, ran over and chased him away. Her account of this harrowing experience was published in the UK newspaper The Guardian. I just read an article you wrote for The Guardian in 2016.
Oh, yes.
An experience you had in Ghana with the taxi driver. When I was reading, especially reading the narratives, that incredible story by William and Ellen Craft, they get away from the plantation. It reads like, you know, the plot of an Alfred Hitchcock movie. They're sitting in the train carriage. A guy who knows who they are is talking to the guy at the ticket collector. You know, there's any moment now, the whole thing's going to fall apart. They're going to be caught.
Exactly.
So many of those narratives read that way. They put you right in that moment. And it struck me that narrative that you wrote does the same thing. And in so many ways, there's these incredibly unpleasant echoes of the past. That as a female, you know, traveling by yourself.
Absolutely.
When you were compiling these narratives, how do you feel as you're reading this material?
My idea for the book was to center on the interior lives of enslaved people, to gesture at this fact that is known by historians of American slavery, but is not as well known by the public, that it was enslaved people's agitation on the slave plantation, their fugitivity, their resistance, and so forth, that really propelled the abolitionist movement. And in centering these people's lives, their interior lives, their private lives, their voices, and that sort of thing, you do, as an editor, I did as an editor, have these moments where I had to put down the materials that I was reading because they happened to be so raw. They felt so real. They felt oftentimes so relevant to our contemporary moment that it was just lamentable. It was difficult. I'm a descendant of enslaved people. I grew up in South Carolina in the shadows of slave plantations. While it was emotional at times for me to put this together, I also knew that this kind of volume could be very valuable to the public, to readers of almost all ages, at least middle school and up, who could really start getting a sense of what slavery was, how it affected people, how it affected enslaved people, and as well as how it affected white slaveholders and other Americans, and the ways that people came together to defeat slavery in the end.
In as much as they did. The speech given by H.4 Douglas, when he's talking about Abraham Lincoln, and, you know, Abraham Lincoln, I guess anybody who's been written about as much as Abraham Lincoln, inevitably there reaches a point where there's sort of all of these assumed truths about that person. And then to read this, a contemporary account, written by a man who, if he didn't know him personally, he certainly had listened to his speeches and had a sense of who he was. All of a sudden, this man, this, you know, this figurehead becomes a kind of everyday politician, and his attitude toward emancipation comes across as rather equivocal.
Absolutely. So that's one of the things that we don't hear very often about Abraham Lincoln. We usually associate him with the Emancipation Proclamation, and we think that he was a full abolitionist. That's like the prevailing kind of narrative about Abraham Lincoln. But Abraham Lincoln actually had an evolution over the years. He always suggested or stated that he felt that slavery as an institution was wrong, but he was very much at one point against Black people having the same rights as white people. And he kind of dealt with pushback from abolitionists for many years, right? So when he says slavery should end, or I'm anti-slavery, I take that position, he was also grappling with this idea of the possibilities for repatriating Black people back to Africa or Central America, even at one point gave some consideration to somewhere in Texas to situate all formerly enslaved people. So Abraham Lincoln is going through a whole lot that we don't often talk about in his sort of evolution, but he never gets all the way to the point where he's thinking that African Americans as a whole should have full citizenship rights upon their freedom and that sort of thing. And that's what H. Ford Douglas is sort of pushing back on. He knows that Lincoln early on, even before he's running for president, he's having these debates. He's voting in certain kinds of ways that are very conservative and definitely not living up to what the abolitionists want, right? So Abraham Lincoln, again, has this evolution over time. It doesn't get all the way to the point that H. Ford Douglas would have wanted. And even in Frederick Douglass's relationship with Abraham Lincoln, they're having this sort of pull and push, right? They're valuable to each other. They can talk to each other about the movement and about the best way to move forward and that sort of thing. But Abraham Lincoln doesn't go as far as the abolitionists would have wanted him to.
Perhaps one of the most valuable assets of this collection is just what you've been saying. You could easily be talking about a contemporary politician. And that, I think, is what comes across over and over again in this collection. You humanize people who are two-dimensional in most historical accounts written in the third person.
Right. But I think that one of the things that the book shows, you know, like you're saying, this idea of two-dimensionality, is that these people are actually thinking creatively about what it would mean to push back on slavery, right? So an enslaver may think, I have these ignorant people of African descent working for me. There's no way that they're thinking the ways they're thinking. But you can see that the enslaved people, as well as all of these abolitionists from different stripes, from different parts of the nation, they basically had enslavers' numbers, right? They had the number of these governmental officials, too. And they were very strategic in how they approached the movement in all these different kinds of ways.
This is Scenic Roots Talking Writing. Our guest is Dr. Michelle Commander, the curator of an anthology tracing the lives of African-American people throughout the 19th century in the U.S. The book is divided into five sections, the first of which deals with the transportation of people from West Africa as slaves in the early part of the 19th century. The last section collects a number of notices sent to the editor of a newspaper in New Orleans, the Southwestern Christian Advocate. The people sending in the notices were attempting to trace members of their family separated by the slave trade.
January 20, 1881. We make no charge for publishing these letters from subscribers. All others will be charged 50 cents. Pastors will please read the requests published below from their pulpits and report any case where friends are brought together by means of letters in the Southwestern. Dear Editor, I wish to inquire for my son. I left him in Montgomery, Alabama in 1865 with my owner, William Belfort. His name is Henry Mason, and my name is Elvira Strood. And the last time I heard of him, he was in Kansas. His father's name was Edward Strood. Please address me at Benton, Mississippi, in care of Reverend J.C. Clemens. May 19, 1881. Dear Editor, I desire information of my brothers and sisters whom I left near Perryville, Mercer County, Kentucky, in 1828. I and my brother Sip and Mary were owned by Peter Lister. I was sold to Captain R. A. Hinckley and was carried to Mississippi and from there to Sabine County, Texas. Brother Sip and Sister Mary were sold to John Lediwich of Mercer County. Jesse Lister, Milam, Sabine County, Texas.
You brought up Frederick Douglass at one point from a speech called The Mission of War.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "We are writing the statutes of eternal justice and liberty in the blood of the worst of tyrants as a warning to all aftercomers. We should rejoice that there was normal life and health enough in us to stand in our appointed place and do this great service for mankind." So he is arguing, mm-hmm. and apparently even in 1864, and perhaps mm-hmm. more so in 1864, it was necessary to argue why the war was being prosecuted at all and to remind people of why it was being prosecuted.
Uh-huh.
That it's not Union dominion over the southern states, it's whether or not the country is going to allow human beings to be enslaved. That's like a year after the Emancipation Proclamation, isn't it? 1864?
That's right. That's right. And so what he's doing there is he's very much attempting to encourage African-American men. I mean, we had volunteers, of course, who volunteered for the Union side, but just to kind of keep that energy going, to let people know what this war was about, as you stated, because you can imagine that in real time, people are already sort of thinking about revising that narrative, right, of what mm-hmm. about what this war was truly about. And of course, today has echoes today, right, of how people want to sort of reconceptualize that moment of the Civil War, especially in the South where I grew up and where you are. People often want to suggest something about states' rights that's divorced from this institution of slavery that has survived in this country for hundreds of years. But he makes it plain. And he, for his Black readership or his Black listeners, people who are listening to him give the speech or who are reading it when it's published later, they are basically endowed or told, you have this kind of responsibility for mankind if we are to truly move forward as Americans and realize the sort of greatness that we suggest that we are, that we will fully realize who we are as American people.
That expression of American idealism on the part of mm-hmm. The framers of the Constitution, that's exalted language, you know, that's humankind reaching to its right. highest potential. It's a nice ideal. But as you pointed out, even in the aftermath of the Civil War, there was a moment when that ideal was almost realized, but almost as soon as it was taken away again.
Right.
But what you're suggesting, and I think it's really interesting because especially given events of the past couple of months, there's always this initiative to reframe the narrative, to reframe the narrative of the Civil War as a fight for autonomy on the part of the South. And I'm sure that probably there are many people in the South at the time, and perhaps still now, who still embrace that narrative, and in their minds, that's the truth of it. That's what's so complicated, isn't it, to try to undo a narrative like that?
Right. It's very difficult, right? I'm not even sure that it will be possible to get to everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
To change the hearts and minds of everyone. You know, that just brings up so much what you've just said about the ways that we teach slavery or don't teach slavery in schools, the kinds of ways that we're prepared to have discussions with our young people when something like the Capitol attempted coup, insurrection, whatever you want to call what happened in January, what it is that led to that moment, like what can we look back to in history to sort of historicize that moment to give our young people and older folks too an understanding of just what occurred and the kinds of longing that the people who were there at the Capitol had for a certain point in history, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the things that this book can do is, again, offer that sort of humanity, right? To sort of think about what slavery did, what it caused. We can see the roots of white supremacy in America, like where it came from, and really have a greater sense of how Americans have responded to things like insurrection in our longer history. But I don't think you can always get to the people who have been told for generations, right, that it's been passed down in their family for generations, a certain story about America. But I do think that this is a good opportunity for teachers to use this book, professors to use this book in their classrooms to really get at some of the arguments of the antebellum era where people are thinking about how wrong slavery was. One of the other things that people who have this sort of, I'll call it a revisionist history or this biased way that they look at history, they frame history, they'll say something like, well, you know, enslavers were people of their times, and this is the product that everyone was making money off of. They're people of their times. They needed to cultivate their land, and this is the way that people did things back then. But this book demonstrates that in the time of slavery, there were people who knew it was wrong, and they were agitating, whether they were enslaved people or free black people, or whether they were a white northerner or someone, a white person in the Midwest. They were thinking about how wrong slavery was. They were very aware about the violence that it took to sustain slavery. And they were doing all kinds of things, giving speeches. They were parts of vigilance committees, I should say. They were publishing abolitionist newspapers. They were writing children's works. They were doing a whole lot. It was very dynamic, this abolitionist movement, because they knew in that moment that slavery was indeed wrong, right? And that it was greed, it was monetary greed that was keeping this institution going for so many years.
This is Scenic Roots, Talking Writing. Our guest is Dr. Michelle Commander, the curator of an anthology tracing the lives of African-American people throughout the 19th century in the U.S. The book is divided into five sections, beginning with the transportation of people from West Africa as slaves in the early part of the 19th century, and ending with a number of notices sent to the editor of a newspaper in New Orleans, the Southwestern Christian Advocate, late in the 19th century. The people sending the notices were attempting to trace members of their family, separated by the slave trade.
November 17th, 1881. Mr. Editor, I write to inquire for my son and daughter. His name is John Baptiste Botlow. Her name, Elizabeth Botlow. Our master was Pierre Botlow. Our home was on Bayou de Glaze, of Vols Parish, Louisiana, near St. Mark's. Left my son in Vicksburg and daughter in Frenier. My mistress' name, Ancine Laura Botlow. My youngest daughter and the one I have with me, Sylvania Botlow. My name, Maria Botlow, but now Mary Brown. My owners were French. I live near Monroe, Louisiana, Ouachita Parish. May 14th, 1885. Mr. Editor, I wish to inquire for my son, Daniel Nathaniel Johnson. He used to belong to Dr. Monette of Washington, Adams County, Mississippi. My name is Millie Johnson. His father's name is Gabriel Johnson. We have another son whose name is Willis Johnson, who left at the same time but has returned, saying that he left Daniel in Nashville. Any information concerning him will be gladly received by Millie Johnson. September 23rd, 1886. We make no charge for publishing these letters from subscribers. All others will be charged 50 cents. Pastors will please read the requests published below from their pulpits and report any case where friends are brought together by means of letters in the Southwestern. Mr. Editor, I desire to find my people, whom I left 51 years ago in Owen County, Virginia. I have neither seen nor heard of them since. My mother was named Betty Callie. Father lived with Mr. Thomas Nelson and mother with Mr. Chickums. I had one brother and four sisters as follows: James Callie, Lucy, Edney, Sarah, and Susan. My grandmother and father were named Lewis and Susan, and they belonged to the Thompson estate. I am very anxious to learn whether any of them still live, and if so, where. Address Melton Napper, Ottawa, James County, Tennessee.
Just as an aside, and I don't mean to be callous, but it's not a very good business model to bring people across the ocean in appalling circumstances where many of them are going to get sick by the time they get to the other side, are not going to be in the best shape, and then to treat human beings who have, despite, as you said, the goal of kidnapping people on the west coast of Africa and taking them across the ocean was an attempt to strip them of their individual agency. But it didn't. Right. But it didn't. That's what comes across in the narrative again and again. These are not passive victims of this treatment. These are thinking, in the case of some of the people whose narratives you've collected in here, very sharp people who, despite all the odds, and the odds are almost insurmountable,
they prevailed.
They got out of the South, and everything about the narratives that are contained in this collection reinforces how different the world was in the 19th century, while at the same time how similar it was. The big difference, of course, was that communication was a lot more complicated. Travel was a whole lot more complicated. To travel 1,000 miles from the South to the freedom of Philadelphia,
and it's
almost impossible, right?
Using a train. Yeah, exactly. So you think about something like the Underground Railroad, where people are escaping from slave plantations in the South by foot, right? Sometimes solo, but oftentimes in groups. So they're moving in groups of people, and they're being shuttled from one safe house to the next. So you have, thinking about communication, I mean, they didn't have cell phones, and they couldn't organize on the internet. So these are people who are passing the word along, and safe house at this church in this particular town. And, you know, then maybe they have to go another certain amount of miles to get to the next place at someone's home, that they get a good meal and they get their strength up, and then they go to the next place to get some freedom in Canada or maybe even to Mexico. So it's very much the case that these are people, you know, like I said before, very much strategizing. They're very, very smart. They're strong-willed. And they're making a difference for themselves and their families, and they're taking huge risks because, of course, anyone who's invested in enslaved people, they don't want to lose their investment. So they're going to go after them with bloodhounds, with their weapons, and they want to track them down. And people often did get dragged back to the plantation from which they ran. People were killed for their fugitivity. But the other thing I should say is that not everybody, of course, attempted to run at all, right? So when we think about the kinds of resistance that enslaved people were up to, there were everyday forms of resistance, like if you worked in the fields, perhaps you worked slowly, maybe you broke tools. There were things like arson that happened, or perhaps if you were someone who worked in a domestic space, perhaps you took some of the food from the kitchen to serve better parts of animals to the enslaved people, or better quality food to enslaved people. But people also did things that we take for granted, like they endeavored to love one another and support one another and to build kinship networks and friendships, knowing that these friendships, kinship networks, these bonds between mother and child, father and child, sister and brother, could be broken at any time should, you know, an enslaver have some sort of financial crisis and need to sell off some of his property. So there are all kinds of ways that people are resisting and they are rebelling, but we don't always hear those stories. That's what I really wanted to get across in Aung San. So you'll see in that section on narratives of slavery that you have different views of how one feels at least a measure of freedom, right? So it could be in loving or creating community, but it also could be in these like very spectacular stories, these heart racing, when you're reading them, you're like, okay, what's going to happen next? Oh my gosh, are they going to make it? Are they going to be caught at this point? You have those spectacular journeys that happen too, which are so important. But like I said, you also have these everyday forms of resistance as well that are just so important for people to learn about, because we don't always get that kind of knowledge in the classroom or in any other way at all.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, just the banality of everyday life is just everything that we take for granted was not available to them. You know, your whole life. But then when I first came to the States, I came here in the early 70s, and people would say to me, wow, you came all the way from England? This is in 1970. This is not 1860, when most people's lives were prescribed by maybe a 10-mile radius. So, you know, when you start talking about somebody who has lived their whole lives relatively familiar with where they are living, but completely ignorant of almost everywhere else in the country, to leave what is familiar, even if it is abhorrent, was an incredible act of courage. They had no idea what to expect, did they?
Nope. They had no idea.
They were jumping off into the void. Which was almost certainly going to be hostile.
So this idea of mobility and travel is really important during this time period. And, you know, we have these fantastic stories of people like William and Ellen Craft who devised a way to escape their plantation in Macon, Georgia. They know that Christmas time is a time where there's relative freedom for enslaved people, where they have a week or so off from their duties, their labor on the plantations, and they took that chance to flee. And their case is so spectacular because you have Ellen, who is a mixed-race woman, who fashions herself as a white enslaver, a male enslaver, who then sets herself up as the enslaver of William, who's her husband, who's darker skinned. And they have this amazing journey that they take. I'll call it a journey, but my goodness, it was marked by so much precarity. And, you know, they could have been caught at any moment. They escape by foot, they make it on the train, and they make it to freedom eventually. But that freedom is marked by all kinds of uncertainty. So if you think about that moment that they leave their plantation in the late 1840s, it's just before the Fugitive Slave Act is passed in 1850. And the Fugitive Slave Act basically says, if you are a fugitive slave and you make it to the North or to a free state, that means nothing. Your slaveholder can come track you down and bring you back to slavery. And so while they did make it to the North, they ended up having to go to England for a while, for I think something like 20 years, because they were so afraid of their enslaver, who indeed was on the lookout for them, right? So he was trying to track them down. Again, this idea of mobility becomes really, really interesting. It was already there, of course, with all the restrictions that were placed on enslaved people's bodies, and these were laws that were codified in every southern state. But it becomes even more kind of stark when you start having these people who've made it to freedom realize that freedom isn't all it was cracked up to be, and they will have to strategize even further, right, to go to England or to make it all the way to Canada or to Mexico or some other country where they could breathe a sigh of relief and actually feel truly free. And William and Ellen end up later in their lives returning back to the U.S. and becoming educators in the South, which is fantastic. So they're still, you know, even though they made it to freedom as individuals, they still saw the abolitionist case. So when they're in England, they're abolitionists, they're giving speeches, they're telling their stories about their experiences in slavery, but they still end up coming back and have a commitment to the community at large, which I think is very, very beautiful and very common for that time for folks who were fugitives from slavery to come back and give their all for abolition or for the uplift of people of African descent in this country.
Arturo Schomburg, a black man from Puerto Rico, whose collection of books, manuscripts, and pamphlets laid the foundation for the current collection of over 11 million items in the center that bears his name, articulated his vision for the center in 1925, writing, "The American Negro must remake his past in order to make his future. History must restore what slavery took away." This compilation, titled Unsung, curated by our guest, Dr. Michelle Commander, is one eye-opening attempt to do just that. This is Scenic Roots.